I'm with Shapan Dasgupta, an independent MP in the Rajya Sabha, but ideologically aligned to the BJP. And if I may add, one of the more thoughtful ideologues in the BJP. Mr. Dasgupta, welcome to the print. Mr. Dasgupta, we've just heard and watched Prime Minister Narendra Modi in Ayodhya. He's delivered a very emotional speech, if you like. Along with him on the dais, there was the RSS chief, Mohan Bhagwatji. What are your first comments on what the Prime Minister said in Ayodhya at the Bhumi Pujan of the Ram Mandir?
Yeah, it was a very thoughtful speech. And there are two traditions of this Ram Janmabhumi movement. The first, which was really, which we witnessed in the public arena from more or less 1989 right up to about 1993-94, was the expression of militancy, which was the expression, which was the popular agitation for claiming the temple. Then it moved from there to a more legalistic and constitutional path of trying to achieve the mandir through either legislation or through a court order. Now that it was finally managed through the court order, I think what Modi ji was trying to say was that there are certain other aspects of Ram which needs to be highlighted. Most of it is the idea of Ram as Maryada Purushottam, the ideal man, the ideal ruler, and therefore the facets of governance which should be which we should consider as part of the inheritance and legacy of Lord Ram should come to the forefront. And the pride of Hindus of having achieved something after such a long struggle should now be channeled into creating an India which is befitting of the larger inheritance of Lord Ram. That, I believe, was the central thrust of Prime Minister Modi's message this afternoon.
So, several questions from your own comments. The first is the struggle for the building of the temple from the late 80s, when then very senior BJP leader, well, he's still a BJP leader, Advani ji, Mr. L.K. Advani, was in the forefront of that Ram Mandir agitation, and you were a journalist there and also covered that very then and covered that very closely. So many years later, 30 years later, do you see this really as a fulfillment of BJP's political campaign to build a temple to Lord Ram, or do you think that it's the faith of millions of people who believe in Ram that is now being expressed?
See, there were two aspects of the movement which were quite clear even in those days. One was that it was guided by a deep devotional element, which is that they saw Ram as Bhagwan Ram.
Right.
And it was therefore a fulfillment of a certain religious order. Along with it came the idea that, you know, it's unjust to have Ram's not to have a temple at what they perceived to be the site of his birth. Mm-hmm. That's one aspect of it. But the other aspect, which was equally powerful at that time, was that in this Ram temple lay a certain sublimated urge of Hindu society for fulfillment.
What does that mean, though? What does that mean?
It means very much that for about 1,000 years or more, Hindus had lived in certain servitude. Political independence had been lost. And along with political independence being lost was a certain series of mental captivity which came about. And therefore, to break out of that, which to some extent was achieved during the struggle for independence, but some of it was incomplete. And it was that incomplete facet which was sought to be done through this Ram Janmabhoomi. Therefore, to wipe out one very important trace of what they saw as a symbol of servitude.
But are you saying that building a temple would be completing or this or sort of avenging this servitude or the so-called servitude? I mean, building a temple going to do that?
It was righting a historical wrong. And therefore, the temple, well, you can see it as a purely a structure of bricks and mortars. That's one way of looking at it. And you're entitled to look upon it that way.
No, I'm not looking at it in that way at all. I'm just asking.
I'm just saying a lot of people might do that.
Sure.
I'm saying that, yes, that was only an outward appearance. But what it actually contained, that essence of that movement, was that it gave rise to a sense that the Hindus must awaken and create the conditions whereby they can be once again totally independent. They can have a certain degree of mental, that mental liberation which came about from that. That the idea of that arresting that sense of permanent defeat, which was really one of the characteristics of India for a very, very long time. So it was really, it meant different things to different people.
No, fair enough. And this is not just a bricks and mortars thing that I'm talking
about. It's not a bricks and mortars thing.
See, you're speaking very eloquently about a permanent sense of defeat, about servitude, mental slavery, and all of that. And while millions of Indians, of Hindus, would like a Ram temple, I'm just wondering whether a Ram temple is going to help them achieve any of that, defeat this mental slavery that you put so eloquently.
No, it's not. Naturally, a temple by itself is never going to do that.
Yeah.
But that was an important symbolic step. You know, you could say that, why do we need an independence? Mm-hmm. You know, independence, after all, was symbolic. It was a replacement of one flag with another.
Independence wasn't symbolic at all. Independence was self-rule.
You take control of it. Now the fulfillment of that control, what does it mean?
Yeah.
It was that fulfillment of that control, taking it a step further. And to my mind, that's what it is. Now, of course, it depends. And that's why I think the Prime Minister's speech is very important. Is what do we now understand by Ram? We've given Ram the due respect, veneration, and placed him at where he should be, at the heart of where Ayodhya. Hmm. Now what do we do? How do we carry out the message of Ram? So it's also the question of what are the different manifestations of Ram which we can find? We can take a very Ugra Ram, you know.
Aggressive.
A very militant Ram. And that also is a part of the Ram tradition. Hmm. But there is also that Ram tradition of Ram Rajya. That's why he invoked that, of what Gandhiji meant. Now, Gandhiji never elaborated what Ram Rajya meant.
Right.
He elaborated, took it further, by quoting from the Ramcharitmanas quite extensively as to what exactly he meant. But basically, it meant that, look, we need to realize our own potential. We've liberated ourselves from, a very symbolic act has been fulfilled. Mm-hmm. Now let's take it a step further. Now, in other words, that's the same thing. The transition of the movement from aggressive militancy, which it marked from one state, to accepting the constitutional order, to getting a demand fulfilled peacefully, without acrimony, as much as possible. Yes,
there will be some acrimony.
Yes, I do agree. There will be some acrimony. There will be some resentment. Some people will nurse a certain degree of bitterness.
But you would understand that, right? It's understandable.
I understand that. But remember, the quantum of bitterness which preceded this, the whole history of India, you know, today, we have, this movement was focused on Ayodhya, but it could just as well have been focused on Mathura. It could just as well have been focused on Varanasi.
But so will it be? Will the next steps be focused on Kashi and in Mathura?
I don't think so. Because at one level, what this has done is that if if it calls for a more honest assessment of what Indian history did.
Who is going to make that
all about? You know, I sincerely believe.
But you know, the Prime Minister himself has been in Ayodhya, Shopan.
Some of course he has been in Ayodhya. Look, I sincerely believe, and this is a personal view, that had the Ayodhya movement, when the movement for the reclamation of the birth site of Lord Ram, when it was happening and it was at its militant peak, had it not been accompanied by this fierce sense of denial of those who can loosely be called the secularists, of saying, no, there was no temple before, this is all a hogwash, and the history of India is not marked by this sort of acrimony, not marked by so many demolitions, etc.
I believe
that it's quite possible that this movement would have taken a slightly different turn.
Like what? Like what kind of turn?
What existed on 6th of December morning, 1992.
Yeah.
What existed was that there was a Mughal shrine.
Yes.
Ostensibly called the Babri Masjid.
No, it was called the Babri Masjid. Why
ostensibly?
It was called the Babri Masjid, wasn't it?
Ostensibly called the Babri Masjid, but which in reality was a functioning Ram temple.
No, it was a functioning Ram temple for only
exactly. So this was the ambiguity of the whole thing.
There's nothing wrong with that.
What I'm saying.
The rise and fall of empire.
There was a certain ambiguity about that structure. It outwardly it looked like a mosque. It was created by the Mughals, but inside it was a Ram temple.
No, but there's nothing wrong.
There was an ambiguity. Whether it was wrong or right is another matter. That was the reality.
No, fair enough.
It is entirely possible that had those claims not been dismissed and been contested so fiercely by the entire might of the establishment, it is entirely possible that that ambiguity may have persisted. Mm-hmm. That's the point I'm saying, and that's a personal view of mine.
Right.
Actually,
it would have been nice for it to be angry.
Whether it would have been nice or not is another thing.
It was not counterfactual. Yeah.
Because it didn't happen that way.
Sure.
And that structure was demolished on December 6th. And hence, after that, the question is there was this whole period hiatus in 1992. To 2020, when we see this thing,
right?
When they see the movement and the legitimization of the claims.
So some would say, Shopan, that you know the presence of the Prime Minister at Ayodhya to participate in the Bhumi Pujan undermines the whole constitutional position of the Prime Minister, because if you have a separation of religion from politics, then his presence undermines that. And then, you know, you remember very clearly
you're using a very French notion of what
perhaps, and maybe in India it's different.
India is very different. We have a system whereby sarvapant samabha. So basically, it means according respect to all religions, not concealing your faith, not concealing your beliefs, but also giving respect to other people's beliefs.
But actually, there are two questions.
India is essentially a very, very religious society.
No,
and the only point where I would say that the state must never get involved in religion is that the state must never actively discriminate, have any institutional legal barriers against a particular religion. That would be unacceptable.
Right. Now, there are two questions that arise from what you said. The first is, you're absolutely right, India is a deeply religious country, you know, with all faiths and disciplines that exist here. Now, Atal Bihari Vajpayee, former Prime Minister of the BJP, was never in the forefront of the Ram Mandir movement. It was always L.K. Advani. How would you contrast that with what Prime Minister Modi is today? I mean, he's in a sense, the culmination of this campaign has been with him at the head.
Atalji always had this belief that the Ram Mandir agitation should be conducted by the Vishwa Hindu Parishad. He had this particular point of view and he expressed it, but he was in a minority in the BJP and he went along with the majority. You know, often people have positions which are not accepted by most of the others. He never participated in the militant agitations, but he was there arguing for the temple in other ways. So I think where the difference between Advaniji and Atalji expressed
and PM Narendra Modi.
PM Narendra Modi was, of course, not a main, no. He was only a secondary player at that particular point in time. Now, the difference is that while they were in the actively participating in the militant movements in some way or the other, Atalji didn't. Atalji made his arguments forcefully, and you can see his speeches in Parliament also. He argued forcefully in favor of the temple. So it's a different, and it's a style of a man, and you know how they operate. And I don't see a major difference between the two. But I think, yes, you're right, Atalji was never part of the militant movement.
So would you say that Prime Minister Narendra Modi is a representation of this militancy or this aggressive movement towards building a Ram Mandir?
Certainly Narendra Modi inherits that tradition. He was a part of it. Most of the BJP participated in that movement. Who, to that extent, as he was a major player in the BJP, he inherits that thing. Yes, he was a part of that. But the larger question you're posing is that should a prime minister participate in this thing?
Yeah.
Why not? It's been passed by a court. A court has actually sanctioned the thing. There is nothing particularly illegal about this whole enterprise. It reflects the sentiments and urges of a very, very large section of India's population. Tomorrow, if a grand Gurdwara is going to be built somewhere, which has a particular historical significance as far as the Sikh community is concerned, I would say the Prime Minister should be there.
No, but the Prime Minister...
If he's invited, he should be there.
Fair enough. Now, but my question about him, the Prime Minister being representative of this militant approach, is that there was a time, both when the Congress was in power and Rajiv Gandhi, who after all got the locks open from in that shrine, in the Babri Masjid shrine, in Babri Masjid, there has been this this sort of point of view that there should be a compromise, which means you build a temple. You don't have to build it on that alleged spot where Lord Ram was allegedly born, but you can build it side by side. But to build it right then to, you know, to make your point, to force yourself to say to the Muslims that, no, we are going to build it here.
I believe that that site had a particular significance as far as the Hindus of India were concerned. It was that site which had a certain significance.
Why was that site so important?
Site was very important. It was not just a question of building a Ram temple. Many Ram temples exist all over India.
So why was that site? Why was that so important?
Because that was the belief. That was the belief, and it happened after demolishing a particular temple which existed there. So it was an act of aggression which took place in 1528. And it was that aggression which deeply hurt. Otherwise, why should a movement persist for so long?
So was it an act of aggression that occurred on 1992, December 6th?
It was an act of counter-aggression. It was an act of counter to try and reverse an initial crime. Yes, it was an act of aggression. Of course it was an act of aggression.
Now some would say, and some are saying, that this is a colonization of Hinduism. That what has happened...
Colonization in what sense?
That one political party, the BJP in this instance, is sort of taking over the, you know, the Hindu faith, which is so multidimensional. You know, you want to believe in Ram, you don't want to believe, you do what you want. But this aggressive, very militant, very colonizing approach is what is at the forefront.
I think this is very spurious. The Hindu faiths, if you might call it, there's no one single thing called Hinduism.
Absolutely.
You know, it's
so that's what it is that you're making it that
it's a post facto invention.
Yeah, so you're making it into one.
It is the Sanatan Dharma, which covers a multitude of traditions, ways of life, etc., etc. Now, as a Bengali, my Hindu faith, customs, rituals are so completely at variance sometimes with the rituals and customs of people in Northern India or even in Western India. You know, for instance, some people are devoutly vegetarian when it comes to their rituals.
Yeah.
And you know, in Bengal, the Durga Puja is not necessarily, or even the Kali Puja is not necessarily a vegetarian occasion.
Yes, absolutely not. Both Kali and the Durga demand their
Does that make me less attached or less my affinity towards people in Western India or Northern India is no less, or in Southern India is no less?
Shobhan, let me just shift tracks a bit now. Today, August 5, is also the first anniversary of the revocation of Article 317 in Jammu and Kashmir. The Srinagar has been shut down. The Kashmir Valley has been shut down. While there is no formal curfew, but, you know, political leaders are inside their homes under house arrest. A former Chief Minister, Mehbooba Mufti, is formally under house arrest. What do you make of that? In your own country, under house arrest?
Yes. It's unfortunate, but...
Is that all you would say, unfortunate?
It is unfortunate. It is very unfortunate but I believe that the integration, the constitutional integration of what was called Jammu and Kashmir into the Indian Union in its fullest sense of the term was achieved through the revocation of Article 370 and 35A. And it was 1 year of it, and it was bound to be a choppy affair. It was bound to be a choppy affair for a different reason, that for 70 years, you'd fed this idea to the people of Jammu and Kashmir, the whole of Jammu and Kashmir, that they're in India, but not really a part of it. You know, something, there was this sort of
ambivalence. Had a special status.
There was an ambivalence which accompanied it.
Well, it was a special status. Yeah.
That ambivalence was removed. The constitutional ambivalence was removed. Mm-hmm. And now they are equal citizens of the Indian Republic with the laws of India operating there. Of course, they can have their own specific laws when it comes to land ownership, etc., as happens in Himachal Pradesh, as happens in Mizoram, as happens in various other places. Those can always be there. Those are those specificities. Now, this is complicated by the factor that it is not merely a question of Jammu and Kashmir. It is also a neighboring state, Pakistan, which has its own interests in that, to fish in troubled waters. And thirdly, there is this element of a larger radical, a form of radical Islam, which is also permeated there. So all these things...
In Jammu and Kashmir, a form of radical Islam.
There are elements of it. It's not inherently organic to Jammu and Kashmir. I take that point, but you cannot deny that elements of it have come into play there.
So tell me,
it's an international current, because it's an international current and it's bound to play. So in that, certain extraordinary steps have been taken. I believe these steps are unfortunate. I hope they are short term. They can be got away with soon. You can have full-fledged, whether it's Mehbooba Mufti, whether it's Omar Abdullah, whether it's anybody, Mr. Lone, anybody should be allowed to function in their own way. And I hope a situation comes very soon whereby this is going to be possible. I believe that it is an aberration. Let's not kid ourselves into believing that this is a natural order. It is an aberration.
The fact that habeas corpus petitions are being thrown out, the fact that
the courts to do that, they need not throw out court, but the courts should also keep that in mind, whatever has to be done. But I would say that the revocation of Article 370 was a very brave and audacious move. It was needed, it was overdue, and it had to be done regardless of the initial hiccups and difficulties which you encounter in the path. And okay, we are encountering hiccups and difficulties, and they've got to be met with a cool way, but with a larger objective in mind, that Jammu and Kashmir that includes every single person who resides there, is very much a part of India, regardless of their faith and regardless even of sometimes of their particular beliefs which they have. Okay. You know, they can have brothers, you know, beliefs which may be very, very inconsistent with the larger view of the republic which we have. Mm-hmm. But even then, they are part of our, they are citizens of India.
So let me ask you the last question, which is that August 5 is the Bhumi Pujan in Ayodhya. August 5 is the first anniversary of the revocation of Article 370. Surely it's not a coincidence.
No, no. It was also not a coincidence that the first Shila Pujan, which was done in Ayodhya, was on November 9th, 1989. And that was the day the Berlin Wall disintegrated. Okay. So that is also of great significance as far as I'm concerned, which heralded a new order in the world.
There is
and I see that as the really the first Shila Puja. Today was a formalization of something which was, took place much earlier.
Actually, what I'm saying is that I think I would like to have a sense an India which is inclusive.
And I believe I would also like it in India where a civilized conversation between you and me,
absolutely,
regardless of our differences, can continue with a sense of humor attached to it.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for your time, Shobhan Das Gupta. Thank you for speaking to The Print.